Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Many of us like to indulge in the use of butter during the holiday season. It adds a note of rich flavor and texture to whatever's on the stove or in the oven. But there's more to butter than a beloved and familiar shortening. Butter has likely been a staple of the human diet since the Stone Age, derived from the milk of not only cows, but sheep, yaks, water buffalo, and camels, and it has also been used in spiritual rituals, as medicine, and as body decoration in cultures across the world. Elaine Kosrova is a former fellowship student at the Culinary Institute of America who began her career in food publishing as a test kitchen editor. She's contributed to numerous national food and lifestyle publications, and she is the author of a new book called Butter, A Rich History. Elaine has traveled to Punjab, India, Cork, Ireland, Brittany, France, and to the Iowa State Fair, among other places, and she joins us this hour of Radio Times. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And lines are open if you've got thoughts or questions about butter, its history, how it's made today, how it was made, baking, etc. Here's the number, 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So, Elaine, you must have a real love for butter.
I do.
To have taken this extensive journey.
Well, a fascination, actually. And, you know, it's a little bit ironic now I'm the author of this book, because for most of my life I took butter completely for granted, as so many of us do, right? But several years ago I started to notice that the butter market was changing rapidly. You know, there was now imported butters, there were cultured butters, there were higher fat butters, whey butters.
And this is in the supermarket.
This is in the supermarket and specialty food stores. And, you know, I remember sitting down to a butter tasting about 8 years ago and saying, wow, this is astonishing. And how is this even possible that they can be so different from each other? You know, textures and colors and the flavors were different. And I thought, you know, butter is essentially made from one ingredient, cream or milk fat. So what accounted for all these variations that I was seeing? You know, some of the butters were sort of ivory colored. Others were deep golden yellow. The textures were really fascinating, because you can have very soft, spreadable butters, ones that are actually a little more greasy, and some that are so dense they're almost like fudge. You know,
And yet you say butter is still viewed as, quote, common.
Yes, it's an everyday staple. You know, that's why most of us, I think, don't really pay attention to it. It's not some special thing that shows up. It's just always there. It's always reliable.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you write, every detail of a particular butter's character is formed from the commingling of three variables. What are they?
Yes. They are man, land, and beast, is what I write in the book. And what I mean by that, really, is man or woman being the butter maker. Because every butter maker brings different technology and tradition to the process. And so my just went out.
You're having a little bit of difficulty with your headphones
The volume just went off.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, there
you're
we
back,
are.
Back working? Okay, terrific.
Sorry.
So you're talking about
man, land, and beast. Okay. So the land, meaning that which supplies the animal with their feed, and it can be grass or grain, shrubs, flowers, weeds. There's many things that form this sort of buffet on the, that animals eat from, and that affects the color, the flavor, the nutrients in butter.
Well, give us a little bit more of an example, something that a particular plant that the cow might be grazing on. How does that affect the flavor and the color?
Well, just actually in grass and grain fed, you know, there's a huge variation. So if a cow is eating grass, for instance, that butter is going to have a beautiful golden color from the beta carotene that's in the grass. But most cows on feedlot, you know, and this is our big dairy farms, they're eating grain 24/7 around the clock and around the year. There's nothing seasonal about their food. So that's why the supermarket butter is so pale and so predictably pale. It doesn't change because the grain does not have that beta carotene content.
And does that affect also the nutritious aspect of it? If there's nutrition
indeed
to be found in
butter. Yes. I am a proponent of grass-fed butter for sure. It definitely has more nutrients, in particular what we call CLA, conjugated linoleic acid, which is a wonderful disease preventive agent in our bodies. And there's very little of it, if any, in grain-fed butter.
Well, you know, looking back in history, you write that we probably wouldn't recognize the world's earliest butters. Mm. Why is that?
No,
what did they look like? I know you don't know what they tasted like.
Exactly.
Perhaps you can take
I can imagine that they were very strong fermented butters because, of course, they were raw. There was no refrigeration. They were made usually inside animal skins. That was the churn, essentially rocking an animal skin. And because goat and sheep were the first animals to be domesticated, they're much easier. They're smaller. They're comfort-loving animals. So because they were the first to be domesticated, we're pretty certain that those were the earliest butters.
Mm. But, how was it determined that, you know, what was rocking in this animal skin was butter? It's all theory, but...
Well, it would have been an accident, honestly. You know, I'm sure the milk was being transported. It would have been whole milk. They wouldn't have sat around and skimmed the cream off like we do. It would have been whole milk in an animal skin. And if it's cool enough, say it's early morning, and it's transported on a rocky road over a mountain, by the time, you know, you get to the other side or something, a good half hour, you open up that animal skin and you could have these beautiful, rich morsels of fat. Mm. So
theorize that somebody tried that and went, wow.
I'm not even sure they tried. It just happened, you know, that it was transporting the milk and it just happened. Yeah, that's the theory. We'll never know exactly. It was at least 9,000 years ago, well before recorded history.
Well, in your travels across the world, you went, as you call it in your book, butter hunting. And again, we're talking about different, you know, four-legged moms, ruminants who are responsible for the primary work. You write of yak butter and butter made from the milk of water buffalo, and also butter from camel, which you did not try.
Not yet.
You plan on trying that.
Right.
You know, you did try some of these different butters.
I did. Yeah.
You know, when it first came to something like yak butter, well, first of all, where were you?
Right.
And then when it came time to try it, was there any trepidation?
Well, I was in Bhutan, and what I had arranged was to hike up this particular mountain where there's a family of yak herders. So this is where they live during the summer. So I hiked up about 13,000 feet and camped beside this family so I could witness first the milking in the morning, which is very traditional style of milking. It's done in the open field with nothing more than a wooden bucket. And then that milk is put into a stream for cooling. So this is very primitive. Nothing really has changed in thousands of years in this process. And so then I was able to witness the next day the butter making from this particular milk. And that also was done, as it has been done for generations, with a simple plunger churn. And again, the milk was not separated, you know, cream from milk portion, as we do in this country. It was the whole milk. It was cultured overnight. It was put into the plunger churn. And the woman, it's always a woman's job. That's another universal
customized. We're going to get into that.
Yes. she just took the plunger churn and went up and down and back and forth and up and down.
So with that motion, what happens?
And so after about 30, 40 minutes, and I got to help her with that, and it's pretty strenuous, good forearm workout. And after that, we just had these beautiful, rich pieces of golden yak butter. It was, you know, right there within the buttermilk, which was left over. So it's kind of swimming in the buttermilk.
So that churning action helps to separate.
That's
the
what it's all about.
The whole,
any kind of churning, you know, is essentially the same process. What you're basically doing is breaking this fine membrane that's around every single fat molecule. Every fat molecule has this fine little cloak around it. And when you break that cloak, that little membrane, the fats coalesce, they come together. We know that now, but for thousands of years, that was magic for a lot of people. They didn't have the science to explain it.
And so while this is happening, you're in the mountains, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And in this beautiful countryside. And
yeah.
And watching this woman do what, you know, her forebears have done for hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years.
Yes.
And so this beautiful yak butter emerges. What does it look like? And tell us about trying it.
Yes. It looks like cow butter. It's a very pale, it doesn't even look like grass-fed butter in particular. It was a pale yellow, and I came to understand that that's the reason it's not so golden is because the grass is quite coarse up in the highlands, so it's harder to digest for the animals. So they can't break out the beta-carotene in the same way. So anyway, it was a pale butter, and, you know, she had this beautiful sort of choreography of separating it with nothing. She used nothing but a wooden spoon to kind of sift it out of the liquid portion and bring it all together. So I was able to taste fresh yak butter, which is very unusual. It's most people taste it down in the valleys and in the markets where it's already highly fermented. But the fresh yak butter was very, very mild. In fact, it wasn't even as sweet as cow butter. I was honestly a little disappointed. I thought it was going to be more exotic tasting, but it really wasn't. It develops over time, again, because it's raw and it's cultured to some degree. But by the time it gets down into the valley, it's usually a pretty funky product, and that's what people associate yak butter with.
So funky meaning?
Yeah, very rancid, pretty, we would say rancid. I think they actually have a taste for rancidity in the Himalayas.
I was going to say, is that part of the culture?
I think that's part of the culture. In the same way we can have a really strong blue cheese, you know, they can have a really strong yak butter. But, you know, for us Westerners, it's that sour, sour, sour milk smell and taste that's pretty off-putting.
It's amazing to think that this process is still happening in this day and age.
Exactly. I mean, and it's happening on a mountaintop. Well, in Wisconsin, they're pumping out 46,000 pounds of butter per hour. You know, that's the industrial side. So,
and actually, we have a comment from a Sue who's wondering if you visited any large-scale dairy operations. And some people, you know, have concerns that today's, you know, milk products, including butter, can come with a side of cruelty. This is Sue's tweet. So,
yes,
did you visit any of these operations?
I did. I went to Grasslands, which is an enormous industrial butter producer in Wisconsin, and I got the full tour. You don't actually see anything being made because it's so automated. The cream goes in, 3 seconds later, you have butter, and then it's off to packaging. So I basically stood among a lot of machines when I was visiting, you know, but I got to understand their process. And, you know, there's a real question around the treatment of animals. You know, I could see in a place like Bhutan, it's such a beautiful negotiation because essentially the herders take the morning milk from the mother, and the whole rest of the day the calves are free to feed from their mother as long as they want, as much as they want. And, you know, we have a system in this country where the calves hardly ever get to have the mother's milk any. So they get a little bit of colostrum in the beginning.
All right, we're talking about butter, not only in this country, but around the world. Elaine Kosrova is author of Butter, A Rich History. And we're going to be talking some more about that in just a moment after the break here on Radio Times. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if you'd like to jump into the conversation. And we will get to calls in just a moment. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this hour we have Elaine Kosrova in studio. She is author of the new book, Butter, A Rich History, and we're taking calls at 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and we'll get to those calls in a moment or so. But first, I just wanted to get to the history of butter a little bit more, used not only as a food, but, you know, there were practical medical applications. And Elaine, if you could just read us a quick passage you include in your book from Pliny the Elder, the Roman author and naturalist. And I think he wrote this, what, circa maybe 79 AD, something along those lines.
That's right, 79, Common Era. In cases where a leech has been swallowed, butter is the usual remedy, with vinegar heated with a red-hot iron. Indeed, butter employed by itself is a good remedy for poisons. For where oil is not to be procured, it is an excellent substitute for it. Used with honey, butter heals injuries inflicted by millipedes. For other kinds of ulcers, butter is used as a detergent and is tending to make new flesh.
Injuries inflicted by millipedes.
What would that be?
I don't know. And do we have a sense of whether it worked? You don't know if you came across any writings about whether butter was actually a great antidote for some of these ailments.
Yeah, this came up a lot, you know, in the very ancient literature. What's interesting is the Romans didn't eat butter. They had no – they associated with the barbarians in the north. So they had no – exactly that. They were just, you know, it was food of the barbarians. It was a northern food. They were all about oil. So it just wasn't part of their culinary scene whatsoever. But they did really believe in it as an ointment, medicine, clearly.
Interesting. Okay. We do have calls coming in to 888-477-9499. So let's go to David in Flemington, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times, David.
Good morning, and thank you both for taking my question regarding butter.
You're welcome.
A butter maven told me not to buy salted butter because when salt is added, one is prevented from telling whether or not the butter is really fresh. Is that true? And thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, you're welcome. That was certainly more true a century ago when butter was heavily salted, about three or four times as much salt as we have now. And so you really couldn't taste some of the defects that arise from it being, you know, less fresh. I don't think that's really the case now. It's just there as a light seasoning. It's not a preservative. I mean, it helps preserve, but it's not. That's not really the intention because now, of course, we have refrigeration. So I buy unsalted butter when I'm baking so I can control the measure of salt in my recipes. But I do like salted butter at the table. That's my preference.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah. So years ago it was used as a preservative. So if salt was not used, did the butter go bad?
Oh, yes.
And when it went bad, so as in other cultures, say in Bhutan, it wouldn't be used. It wasn't accepted.
Well, what I'm talking about in the States in Europe, where butter was actually brined. It was actually formed, you know, into balls and then put in a brine bath. It was pickled, or it was heavily salted right in the buckets that it was preserved in. So, yes, it's a highly perishable product. What you have to keep in mind is that when the butter season, you know, was the most rich, spring and summer, that's also when the temperatures are high. So it's much more prone to spoilage. So salt was really their only defense against the bacteria that would eventually spoil the butter until we developed refrigeration.
Okay. And again, you traveled the world to research this book, Butter, A Rich History. And Elaine, one of your stops was in Ireland, where you found what you call your own holy grail at the Cork Butter Museum. Tell us about that.
Yes. I specifically went there to see a bog butter. They have a 1,000-year-old bog butter. And for those of you who haven't heard about that, the bog butters are these ancient butters. Some is as old, as I said, 1,000 years old, but some are actually more recent. They've found them in the last 300 years, 400 years old, you know, samples that are not quite so old. But these butters were put into the peat bog in Ireland, either wrapped in some grasses or some linen or perhaps in a firkin, which is a wooden bucket. And they were buried in the peat bog. And for years, people assumed they were buried there because the peat bog is a great place to avoid spoilage. Again, it was, you know, one thing that the Irish had that many people elsewhere in the world didn't have to keep their butter because the peat bog is very acidic. It's anaerobic, so it's this perfect place to preserve things. But what we have come to realize now as we've found more and more of these bog butters, I believe there's about 420 or 30 samples that have been found. Yes, and so what is believed now, because they've been able to map these findings, look at where all the bog butters have been discovered, and the picture is emerging that it was actually a pagan offering, you know, to the elementals, to the fairies, okay. Which makes a lot of sense because butter was very valuable. You know, why people would just leave it there? Yeah. They certainly wouldn't forget about it. So, you know, it did help preserve it to some degree, but the ones that were left there certainly had another reason for being in the bog.
So some of these bog butters that have been discovered, I mean, they're, hundreds of years old, if not
a thousand. Yes, right.
So there's no chance that even though they've been somewhat preserved that anybody would have tried those?
Actually, I have read in the files of people trying, you know, so anthropologists, archaeologists trying them. They're actually still edible officially, but, you know, not pleasant, but definitely apparently they're just super waxy and hard.
Yeah.
And that's what the one in the museum in Cork, you know, if you're ever in Cork in Ireland, go to the Butter Museum. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it sounds great. Well, so what in Ireland, what is the butter like?
Well, nowadays, you know, back in the day, there were so many small little farms because Ireland has such beautiful pasture. And I
cows?
Write, cows. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all cows. It's all cow butter. And I write about, you know, how Ireland really dominated the butter scene around the world for most of the 1800s. And it was because, you know, they had this beautiful pasture. Every butter was, of course, you know, handmade on the farm and then brought to a butter exchange in Cork and then shipped around the world. But nowadays, butter is pretty much synonymous with Kerrygold butter, which is a lovely butter. You know, it's a cooperative. They bring in all the milk from all around. And so the butter is made in a big plant. It's very commercial, but the milk is still beautiful. It's from the pasture. It's from cows that are generally quite happy. And so that's synonymous with Irish butter. I do cover one artisanal butter in my book, a couple who has kind of rediscovered small batch Irish butter making.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, is there a difference in flavor between the mass-produced butter or the artisanal butter? Have you found? Because I think at some point in the book, you just kind of caution not to necessarily knock factory-produced butter.
Absolutely. No, I think we're very lucky that when we go to the supermarket and, you know, we want to do our holiday baking, that our butter is very standardized, that we always get the same results. And it's also very clean. It's a very clean product. You know, we take that for granted now, but that really wasn't the case for many centuries. So I do think there's a place for affordable, standardized butter. The artisanal movement is just making it more interesting. And I think particularly for table butters, not so much utilitarian butters, because the artisanal butters are expensive. Yeah. And it's also, I make the point too, just because it's small batch doesn't mean it's a great butter. You know, I've had artisanal butters that, you know, it's nice they're making it, but it's really not that special.
Yeah.
So you do have to taste and sample and find out, you know, particularly where the cream is coming from and the animals. If you know that a farm, for instance, has Guernsey cows or Jersey cows, there's a good chance that butter will be outstanding if it's properly made.
So because, within the cow community,
yes,
some breeds
are
just better? Produce
yes,
better?
They produce a richer milk, a milk with more solids in it, and those solids give us these compounds. You know, there are 120 flavor compounds in butter. And some of them are only detectable when you heat the butter, which is why melted butter on toast tastes so wonderful as opposed to cold butter on your toast. So different cows, animals in general, but if we're just talking about cows, the composition of their milk shifts. And a Guernsey milk, for instance, is very rich and the fat is golden and beautiful. So, you know, we're talking subtleties here, and it certainly depends what that cow is eating. If that cow is not on pasture, if they're eating grain, that's going to affect it. You know, so there's a lot. I keep coming back to those three important variables. You know, the butter maker, the plants, and the.
We're both drawing a blank. I know you did this at the beginning of the show, and we'll get
the
it.
Animal.
We'll get
the
it. There
animal
you go. Yeah, that's an important factor.
Yeah, the animal.
Okay.
The animal plants. So,
All right. Well, we're talking to Elaine Kosrova, who is author of the new book, Butter, A Rich History. And we're taking calls and comments at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. And I'd like to just talk some more about camel butter in just a moment. Okay. But first, let's get to some of these comments from our listeners. Okay. Marie tweets, isn't there a risk of the spread of tuberculosis from raw milk products like cheese and butter or disease?
That's a very 19th century concern. I really believe that that's where how we got the movement toward pasteurization was because there was TB and there was disease. But really, the dairy industry now is so clean, and we have refrigeration. We have great sanitation. I myself buy raw milk all the time because I live near a farm, and they make raw milk. So for me, it's not an issue. There are other people that would debate that. But that is, you know, she's calling on something that historically was correct, about 100 years ago.
All right, an email from Judy who says, I learned from a friend of mine who grew up on a dairy farm in Switzerland that butter didn't need to be refrigerated if you use it on a regular basis. Is this true?
Yes, it's true.
So what does regular mean?
Well, you can keep a stick of butter out for, I'd say, a week, depending on the room temperature. You know, that's going to affect how it keeps. I do keep my butter. I have a little butter keeper that's specifically designed for that. It's a little ceramic thing with water that, if you're not familiar with it, I can describe it. It's cool little. It's like a ceramic cup. You put your butter in there, your soft butter in there, and then you turn it upside down over into another ceramic cup where there's a little pool of water, and that water then creates a seal so that the butter keeps much longer.
Interesting.
And I want to just mention, too, that if the butter is kept out and it starts to ferment a little, you know, you might detect that it's getting a few off flavors. That's not bad for you. It's just you might not enjoy it, but it's not going to hurt you. It's just a natural development of bacteria in the butter.
Right. Okay, two camels, you include a picture in your book of a man milking a camel.
Yes.
He seems to be standing on one leg and balancing the bucket on his other knee, which is lifted, and it just looked like
it's just amazing.
Such a difficult.
Yes. Yes.
A bit of a trying process.
Yes. Yeah. So I wish I had seen that firsthand, but I have not seen that done firsthand. But it's remarkable. Even if the animal moves a little bit, then what does he do? You know, perched on one leg.
Yeah. Well, you also write the camel butter usually contains many impurities.
Because it's the desert, there's a lot of wind, there's usually sand that gets into the camel milk and the butter. Often camel hairs are reported in it. It's hard to make it a pure product traditionally done. I've not been to a modern camel dairy. I'm sure it's a different story.
Is there such a thing?
Oh, yes. There are modern camel dairies.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think this picture we spoke of came from someplace in the Algerian Sahara, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
But, all right. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's camel milk is quite a staple in other parts of the world. And there are some camel dairies in the States that are just starting to, I think, become a bit more commercial. So we might hear a lot more about camel milk and perhaps camel butter in the future.
All right, back to the phones. Kyle in Glassboro, New Jersey. You are live with us on Radio Times. Hi, Kyle.
Thanks for having me on there.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening?
So my question is, my father actually makes a porcini butter from the porcini mushrooms. He produces a lot of mushroom butter. I was wondering if you had the chance to ever tried that and what you think about that mushroom butter movement.
I've had a lot of different flavored butters, and in fact I include a few recipes in my book for flavored butters. Butter is an ideal medium for carrying flavors, whether they're spicy or sweet, savory. So a mushroom butter, because mushrooms themselves have quite a bit of umami flavor in them, I would think that would be absolutely delicious. Yeah, that's a good one to try.
So why add that to the butter, Kyle? What prompted that?
He's a mushroom farmer in Northern California. So I think he definitely wanted to spice up what you can do with mushrooms. He's definitely like big on proponing their natural flavors and abilities and what they can do for people.
Mm-hmm. Is he selling it somewhere?
Yes, he is. You can actually look up his company. Mm-hmm. It's you can look up his name, Google it, Kenny Rosner.
Yeah, okay.
He's a mushroom man, Northern California.
So okay. I'm just curious, so, before we let you go, what does the mushroom add to the butter? Is it like a dusky note?
Well, porcini is a very flavorful mushroom.
Yeah, definitely. He has a few different flavors, different types of mushrooms he uses. His company is called Shroom Shack. If you want to check it out, check out his website.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, Kyle. All right. And we've got a tweet from Joanna who asks, aside from color, how can you tell if the cows are eating well and healthfully from the butter?
Yeah, really good question. It's not that easy. You have to do some research. That has been what I've discovered, because even on the label, some companies will say grass-fed, you know, the cows are on pasture, but in fact, you know, that could be a very small amount of grass, a very small amount of time on pasture. So it's tricky. There's no regulations about a lot of the labeling on butter.
So yeah, and in this country, you write, Elaine, that the color, you know, if there are color additives put into the butter here, that doesn't necessarily have to end up in the label.
That's true. We have this loophole for butter makers that goes way back to the margarine wars that they had, you know, the battle with margarine back in the day. So butter makers don't legally have to claim on their label if they've added coloring. And that's unfortunate. It's not really fair to the butters that are naturally yellow. Yeah. So it's not always an indication. Like I said, it's a good, if you, you know, we eat butter, if we eat butter every day, it's a staple, and it's worth seeking out a healthy product.
Sure.
Paying a little bit more money for it, too.
All right. We're talking about butters from across the world as food and as more. And after the break, we're going to talk to you about what you found about Tibetan butter sculpture.
Yes.
And the monks who produce this. Mm-hmm. And so we'll get into that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Again, our guest is Elaine Kosrova, who's written the book Butter, A Rich History. And if you'd like to join us here in the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and Elaine Kosrova is with us. Her new book is Butter, A Rich History. And speaking of history, I'm imagining, what, 10 centuries, thousands of years perhaps, monks in Tibet have created butter sculpture. Tell us about that and what the significance is.
Yeah, this was a fascinating chapter to write. I call it sacred and spiritual, that particular chapter. And first of all, I discovered universally that many ancient cultures used butter as this sacred tool in their spiritual practice. You know, you look across history, and the Sumerians, the Vedic Aryans, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Druids, they all had these fascinating worship rituals that involved the use of butter. But the one that has survived is the Tibetan butter sculpture. And that, again, began, I believe it's 900 B.C. Mm-hmm. And, yes, it's remarkable because they were using butter. They were sculpting butter in Tibet before that, but it was specifically a pagan ritual. So they were familiar with basically taking yak butter and mixing it with a little flour and creating this paste so they could create their own pagan sculptures. But then when Buddhism came to Tibet, it really sort of upped the game and turned into this very elaborate process of sculpting various deities. And these are called tormas. These beautiful sculptures are called tormas. And tormas are essential for Buddhist practice. They're put on the altars, and they vary depending on which intention a person has for their prayer or what the prayer festival is. But in general, they're just very beautiful, elaborate sculptures that are, you know, essential to their practice.
And when it comes to working with butter, cold is a real factor, right?
Yes, of course.
You write that traditionally these monks would work in extreme cold to do their sculpting, which could lead to any number of physical ailments on their part.
Yes, it was really a test of their devotion, just the act of making the sculpture itself, because they would have frostbite. You know, they had to sit in the same position. They had to work with incredible detail, so it affected their eyes. But, you know, this was considered part of their calling to do this work. So there was great pride. If you were an artist, you know, with beautiful sculptures, that was very much to your credit as a monk.
All right, let's go to the phones once again. Frederick in Conshohocken, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
Good. Look, that question, in your research, have you come across Dennis Weston Price and his work with using butter therapeutically, meaning he used butter that was grown from fast-growing wheat, rye, or the barley grass, fed on those foods, and he used the butter to actually treat help to treat tooth decay. Have you ever heard any work about him?
I am familiar with his research. I believe it was done in the 1930s, and he looked at a lot of remote civilizations and compared their diet with more industrial, sort of their counterparts. So if he was, like, in Scotland, he was looking at really remote Scottish people compared with their counterparts in the cities and comparing disease. And, you know, his main finding was, you know, animal fats were very important to the health of people, you know, natural animal fats. So, yeah, I'm familiar with Sally Fallon and her book. She's basically the face of the Weston Price Foundation. So I am familiar with a lot of those, that diet study. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Thanks, Frederick, for the call to Radio Times. So, well, you know, Julia Child famously said, don't be afraid of the butter, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You know, but Elaine, is, we all know what, for the past 40 or 50 years, you know, butter and other saturated fats have, you know, been linked to ailments, you know, heart disease, cardiovascular disease. Has butter, are we finding now that these fats might have gotten perhaps a bad rap? Has anything?
Absolutely.
We're hearing more of a shift.
Absolutely. You know, the anti-fat campaign really got going, you know, in 1977 when the FDA said, we're having too many heart attacks, you've got to restrict your fats. It's all about fats in the diet, you know. And I think it gained a lot of traction because intuitively it made sense to people that, oh, if I have fat on my body or in my body, it's because I'm eating fat. But that is a gross oversimplification. It's just not how our bodies work, because everything is basically broken down in our digestion and then reassembled as the body needs. And so, you know, we've had this long 50-60 year campaign against fat, and it actually hasn't gotten us any healthier. And so now everyone is asking these questions, and, you know, experts and people alike. So what's the story? You know, I mean, we've made headway with heart disease, but that's mostly because we've gotten so good at replumbing the heart, you know, with stents and bypasses.
So margarine hasn't helped?
Not at all. In fact, margarine definitely, you know, with trans fats, margarine contributed to heart disease for sure. We know that now. And also we smoke a lot less. You know, smoking is causes great inflammation in the body, and that's definitely a trigger for heart disease. So it's a very complex picture, but the bottom line is that butter, you know, saturated fats are a large category of fats. And we know that, for instance, some of them have no effect whatsoever on your cholesterol level. Stearic acid, which is about a third of butter, has no effect on cholesterol levels. And oleic acid is a monounsaturated fat. That's in butter. That's also in olive oil. No effect on your cholesterol levels. And the saturated fat that is in butter that affects your cholesterol also increases your good cholesterol, the HDLs. But I do want to make a point, because the whole cholesterol number game is, it might itself be quite misguided. You know, I came across this study not that long ago by UCLA, and they found that I think there were more than 3,000 people that they looked at, and each person was admitted to the hospital for a heart attack. 75% of those people, 75%, had normal or below normal cholesterol levels, and yet they had a heart attack. And now we know people with high cholesterol can have no heart attack. So that whole issue, you know, we're looking much more now at inflammation as the fundamental trigger for heart disease, because that can cause the accumulation of fat. But what caused...
To be continued, right? Yeah, right. The research to be... And it, as always, if you have any questions about adding something to your diet or removing, you know, check with your physician.
Well, I have a degree in food nutrition, so I worked on this chapter really hard, and I basically had to unlearn much of what I was taught in the 1980s in college. Yeah. When it comes to fat and calories and cholesterol and all of that. So it's all good news. You know, that's the bottom line. Like there's, it's good news for butter for sure. But
perhaps
even for
we don't
foods,
have to be afraid of the butter then.
That's right.
Especially as we're heading to the holidays. And hopefully we can get a little bit of information about recipes before we wrap up the hour. But I did want to get to, you know, on the lighter side, you know, back to the United States. You did visit the Iowa State Fairgrounds.
Yes.
And the yearly sculpting of the butter cow, which has been a tradition for well over a century here in this country. So tell us that story.
Yeah, that was a fun week standing inside a cooler with, it was the middle of the summer, but I had my winter coat on because basically the cow is sculpted inside a giant refrigerator. And Sarah Pratt is the sculptor, and she's been doing it for several years now. And yeah, it's a very, you know, it's been done for generations now, and it's more or less the same process where they create a skeleton frame using chicken wire and wood. So it's in the shape of a cow, and then the butter is just slowly applied in layers, one on top of the other, to get the shape of the cow. And then Sarah has special tools that she uses to make the ears stand up, to make the tail look more fuzzy, furry, hairy. She spent a lot of time carving the udder and the veins that are around the udder. It was a, you know, I basically helped a little bit, but I'm not a sculptor, so I was watching the process, and it took about a week.
But one thing you did discover was that they don't waste that butter.
That's right. Yeah, that's
he's maybe reappearing.
Yeah, I write in my book how when I first walked in that room, it was kind of an assault of bad butter smells, because they scrape that butter off the cow each year and put it into buckets and save it, you know, the right thing to do. You don't want to waste 600 pounds of butter, which is essentially how much it takes to do that.
All right. Continuing with our comments, and I think we're going to seesaw back to health here. We have a tweet from Sarah who says vegan butter is better for the environment when palm oil free and better for cholesterol levels. And of course, you know, she puts it better for the animals, too. So is that something that you have you gone outside animal butters in your research?
I have not. I was specifically looking at, you know, butter as it has been made and used traditionally, you know, throughout history. Certainly, you know, vegans have the choice of not using dairy products, and I'd certainly respect that.
Sure. All right. So, you know, among the items on your resume, you, Elaine Kostrova, studied pastry arts, worked for a time as a dessert chef. I have to say, personally, there's nothing like baking with butter.
Yes.
How do you think it influences flavor and texture of, say, a home-baked cake as compared with other shortenings?
Yes. Butter, because you can beat it. I discovered in my research, in fact, that the creaming step, when you make a cake, you take butter and sugar, excuse me, and you cream it, excuse me, and you... that process is basically to beat air into the butter. And so that's one reason why a butter cake can be so light and tender and, you know, really has this great loft. Whereas you, if you were to take oil and do the same thing, you would not get the same texture. It would just be heavier. So butter has this ability to capture air within it. That's really helpful in making cakes. It's fascinating, really, the versatility of butter in the kitchen, whether you're baking or cooking. You know, and much of it is related to temperature. If you think of, you know, soft butter for creaming, but then cold butter for making pastry.
Sure.
You know, melted butter for sauces. It has this interesting life around temperature that allows us to be really creative with butter in the kitchen.
So if a home cook wants to use butter in a recipe, what sort of butter would you recommend?
As I mentioned before, I do generally buy unsalted butter for my recipes for my baking, so I can try the control the degree of salt. But also sometimes I want a higher fat butter. And these are often called European-style butters. They have 82 or 84% butter fat as opposed to 80%, which is the normal supermarket kind. And I like that higher fat butter for my pastries. If I'm making cakes, I don't need it. I just use the 80%. But having that extra butter fat, it's easier to work with. And because there's less water in the dough, you're much less likely to get a tough dough or a soggy dough. So it's important, I think, to make that little distinction, you know, 2% or 3% more butter fat makes quite a difference in pastry.
And an important note, when storing it in the refrigerator, you need, and I've learned this the hard way, if you don't wrap it well, it starts to smell like the onion that it was stored near.
Absolutely. Yes, it does need its own. Yeah, I wrap it well and then usually put it inside a plastic container, too.
So we have an email from Stephen who says, what about ghee? That's G-H-E-E. Explain ghee to us.
Yes. Ghee is clarified butter. It's a type of clarified butter. I would like to say, you know, to clarify a point, actually, that all ghee is clarified butter, but not all clarified butter is ghee. And what I mean by that is when ghee is made and butter is melted, it's simmered for quite a long time to drive off all of the moisture. And the reason this was developed was because that moisture can be a breeding ground for bacteria and spoilage. So in India and parts of North Africa, this is traditionally how they kept their butter from spoiling. They simmered it, and then they would separate the oil that arises from that.
And that is the ghee?
That is the ghee. So that butter oil is the ghee. When you cool it down, it becomes firm again. It doesn't look like butter necessarily. It's much more grainy, and it doesn't taste precisely like butter because often these milk solids that also come out when you simmer, they basically fall to the bottom of the pot, and those are super flavorful. And in India, they actually scrape those off the bottom, and they make candies out of it. And it's that quintessential butter flavor or in those solids, believe it or not. So the ghee is a much more practical a cooking medium, essentially, instead of using oil. But I like it because it has a really high smoke point. It doesn't burn. If you're going to sear a meat or something like that, it's wonderful for that.
Is that easy to find in this country?
It's getting much more easy to find ghee. Mm-hmm. But just be careful it's not made from hydrogenated oil because there are some imposters out there. It's not all natural butter, obviously.
So in your book, you do include some recipes, Butter's Greatest Hits, as you call them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of tough to do recipes over the radio sometimes.
Yes.
But hopefully in the remaining 30, 40 seconds we have, you can tackle better buttered popcorn.
Yes.
Do you have that up the top of your head, how to do that?
Yes. You simply make a clarified butter. As I was saying, you melt the butter in the pot and skim off that the oil. You don't want the water because that's going to make your butter soggy. And definitely include some of those solids. Whip those solids back into the butter oil that you have because there's a lot of flavor on them. So the whole point is to basically get rid of the water, drive off the water. Mm-hmm. And what's left, pour that over your popcorn.
Yep, sounds yummy.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was great fun to have you here with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Elaine Kostrova's new book is called Butter, A Rich History. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page and you can listen to our podcasts at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Noree. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.